Hi, I think we're going to get started, if everybody can hear me. My name is Julie Halpert, and I will be moderating this panel. I'm a freelance journalist, have been for over 20 years. I started out in the environmental field and covered environment and science, but I haven't been as successful as freelancing exclusively on these issues, but these other panelists have. So we hope to share their insights with you, give you some really good tips, everything from how to pitch to how to manage, how to juggle your finances and how to apply for grants, all kinds of great, we hope, really useful tools. Just out of curiosity, how many people here are currently freelancers? How many people want to be freelancers? Oh, great. So we hope you'll have a lot of good take-homes. And my outlets, I have a broad swath of publications I write for. I just wrote for Mary's publication, Enzia. I cover a lot of car coverage for Automotive News. I also cover other things like parenting for the New York Times, and I've written for The Atlantic, Wall Street Journal, as well as lots of other publications. So I wanted to introduce our fantastic panelists. We have Nancy Averett. Did I pronounce your last name right?
Yes.
She's a former newspaper reporter who lives in Cincinnati, Ohio. She began freelancing in 2006 and has written for numerous consumer magazines and websites, including Audubon, Pacific Standard, Discover, Environmental Health Perspectives, Bioscience, and others. She also creates content for medical institutions and teaches journalism classes to college students at Miami University of Ohio and Xavier University. She's going to talk a bit about how to have sort of a broad swath and not just strict journalism as a way to supplement your income. Since this is actually called How to Freelance and Not Go Broke, that is clearly our goal, is to show you how to do that. Rachel Neuer is one of our award-winning freelance journalists. This year, she won the She regularly contributes to the New York Times, National Geographic, BBC Future, and more. Her first book, Poached, Inside the Dark World of Wildlife Tracking, was published in September. She's also a recipient of the 2018 SEJ Environmental Reporting Awards, winning a first place for beat reporting for a large market. So we're excited to have her. And to get the editor's perspective... Oh, I'm so sorry. Is this better? Okay, Mary Hoff is going to give us the editor perspective. She's editor-in-chief of Enzia, an independent nonprofit magazine presenting new perspectives on environmental challenges and solutions to a global audience. And she has more than two decades' experience helping to improve understanding, appreciation, and stewardship of our environment through print and online media. So the way I want to work this is I'm going to have them speak super briefly for like 5 minutes each, and then I'm going to ask them some questions, and we're going to just leave lots of time for your questions, because I presume you have them. I also have a couple people who've contacted me who have their own areas of expertise, and if we have time, perhaps you can contribute or chime in. One in particular is Genevieve here. Anyway, she has tips about running a small business. Oh, yay. Okay, great. So we'll involve you later. Nancy, why don't you start and just give a brief perspective on and your thoughts on this topic.
Okay. Can you guys hear me? Okay. Just real briefly, I started in 2006, and I really had no idea what I was doing. And quickly, I didn't start as an environmental reporter. I actually started pitching Runner's World because I ran in my free time, and I thought, oh, I'm sort of an expert on that. But mostly because I really, at that time, really liked the publication. They had a lot of good stories in there, and I kind of went from that to other publications, and now I do pretty much science and environment full-time. But it's changed a lot, the industry, since I've been doing it, and I think it's definitely gotten harder to make a living as a freelancer, and I can talk a little bit later about that, but I do a lot of juggling, and most people I know who freelance for a living are juggling sort of their money-making writing work with their passion for journalism on the side. And I wish it wasn't that way, but it seems to be, at least right now. So, but that's definitely doable, and that's how I do it.
So talk a little bit about that. What are some side things you do? You mentioned teaching. You mentioned your other kind of writing. What are examples of things that you do to supplement the journalism that you're passionate about?
Right. So, I mean, I'm first and foremost I was trained as a journalist, so that's what I'm most comfortable doing. I'm sure you guys have heard the term content marketing. There's a lot of need out there for content, and it's very similar to the kind of work you do in journalism, but it's not technically journalism. So, and I don't want to do that in the environmental field because that would be a conflict of interest and could be problematic when I'm pitching publications. So I stick to, not really sure how this developed in my life, but I do a lot of medical writing. And I think that worked out to be a good area for me because it's still science-based and there's a lot of hospitals and medical schools that are looking for a copy. And it's very, you know, you're interviewing a lot of times doctors or researchers and you're writing about their study or you're telling a feature story. It's just that you're never going to write anything negative about the institution, so it's not technically journalism. But those kinds of situations pay pretty well. And but yeah, I have also taught at the university level, and I think you do that as well, mm-hmm. correct?
I do.
Yeah. I haven't found that to be tremendously lucrative, but I still have dreams of it being that way. I mean, it's being an adjunct is typically what a lot of places want, and you're never going to make very much money doing that. But I do have met people here that are doing it maybe on a part-time basis. There are a lot of journalism programs where they're looking for people who have experience. You don't have to have a PhD. You might have to have a master's to teach those journalism classes. So yeah, if you can get one of those gigs, you could do well, although I think you might run into the problem of if it turns out to be a full-time gig that you're not going to have any time for your journalism. So one thing I'll just say quickly is that it's a huge juggling act, and I think that's one of the hardest things. Your mind is always in 10 different places at once. So you have to guard your time and try to pick projects or side projects that aren't going to be so draining. You don't have any time for journalism, or you'll be frustrated.
And by the way, I teach a class at the University of Michigan, a journalism class, in the fall and the winter. I team teach it with Amelia Scarry, who's chairing the conference. We've been doing it for almost 20 years, and I don't have a master's. I just have a bachelor's. Also, it's a consistent gig, which if you're a freelancer, consistent gigs are, you know, that's the best. So there is the value of that. Rachel, I think it would be great to have you talk a bit about your award and finding multiple stories to cover from a single topic. I think that's an interesting way to generate more stories.
For sure. Well, just to start out, I do make almost 100% of my living freelancing. I love the juggling act. That's just what I thrive off of. I've been doing it since 2011 when I graduated from NYU's Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting program. I feel like at that time freelancing wasn't a popular option. It wasn't something that my program really strongly prepared me for. It was sort of like a last resort kind of presented to me in that way. I haven't found that to be the case. I think I make more as a freelancer than I would as a staff writer. I think I'm more prolific. I'm more excited about what I do because it's kind of a challenge, just like how many clips can I get? How much money can I make? So I love the lifestyle. It definitely has its highs and lows, but I would encourage anyone who likes to hustle to try it out. So getting multiple clips out of, for example, a trip is one of the ways to make it work. I just won the SEJ Beat Reporting Award for a bunch of illegal wildlife trade stories I did. All of them had to do with this book that I was reporting, but to help pay for the book and to get word out about the topic and the book, I was, of course, writing as I went along. So an example of that would be a trip I took to South Africa. I got a grant from the Pulitzer Crisis Center, which everyone should apply to, by the way. They have so much money, and they're really generous, and the grant process is not that long. Anyway, they sent me to South Africa, and I wrote a feature story for Newsweek about rhino horn trade. Then I covered a big conference called CITES. You guys are probably familiar with it, for the New York Times. I wrote a travel story for Delta Sky magazine, and I popped up to Malawi to write about drones for the New York Times. So that was all one trip, 2 weeks, 4 or 5 clips, which is excellent and a way to really monetize it.
And can you talk a bit about the process of applying for grants? Because some people may not know about that.
Definitely. Every grant is different. I've only gotten a couple. I received an SCJ FEJ grant a couple years ago. I applied last year and didn't get it, but still managed to do this story, which was nice. The Crisis Center, the Pulitzer Crisis Center, has been the least painful grant process I've ever gone through. It's really short. They get back to you very quickly. The money's in your bank account. It's just, it's highly recommended for anybody who does traveling. Some grants are really burdensome to apply to. There was one, I think it was Sloan Foundation, that I applied to for book stuff, and it became like an entire part-time job unto itself just to apply for this grant, and then I didn't get it. So I don't know what the method would be to figure out if a grant is good for you or what your chances are. I still certainly haven't figured it out myself, but there's a whole spectrum, and occasionally it does pay off.
And how do you find the grants to apply for?
I think SCJ actually has a page, or maybe it's NASW. Somebody has a page with just, like, grant opportunities for science journalism. Word of mouth, ask me, ask other freelancers, ask everybody at this conference.
Great. Mary, I wanted you to talk a bit about, as an editor, what you look for in a pitch, what your perspective is like, and you'd mentioned you have an example of a bad pitch, which I'm sure everybody would like to hear.
Thank you. Is this, how's my volume? Doing good. Okay, great. Yes, so I'm sort of on the other end of things. The stories get tossed at me, and I'm the one that decides whether we're going to engage with you and eventually pay you for what you do. So I do have some advice. Has everybody here done pitches, have a general idea about what pitches are like, so I don't have to go into the basics of it? Okay. I'll give you a couple good pitch, bad pitch things. First and foremost, whatever outlet you're pitching, find and follow the pitch guidelines. Every outlet's going to be different, and you want to make them happy. You're not trying to make a different outlet happy. It's very helpful if you're pitching by email to put the word pitch in the subject line, along with just a few words that give an indication of what the pitch is about. I have inadvertently at some times, I've got, like you, I get hundreds of emails. Every once in a while, something looks like it's a press release or spam or something like that, and then I find out that it was a pitch that was disguised.
Although public relations people title their subjects pitches as well.
Well, that is so true, too, but they use capital letters, so.
That's great to know.
For our outlet, we prefer short and sweet pitches. A couple of paragraphs will do. Other outlets like to see more than that. So again, figure out what they want. But the more that that you can get your idea across in a very short space, you have to capture me. I'm skimming. So there has to be something in the first couple of sentences that really capture my attention. Let me know why you think this story needs telling. If there are other dimensions of the story out there already, tell me why this goes beyond and why it's important to go beyond what I've already read or encountered elsewhere. Ways to lose me in the pitch stage, just a couple of things. First of all, send a really long, rambling pitch that doesn't say what it's about until the last sentence. Kind of the mystery writer's approach. I'm not going to make it to that last sentence. Pitch a story we've already told. One of sort of the pitch 101 things is look at what the outlet has already published and don't pitch that. Check in after about 4 hours to see whether I've had a chance to review your pitch or not.
Seriously,
believe it or
within
not.
4 hours. Is that what you're saying?
This is a don't. This is a
don't.
I was like,
what? Sorry.
And believe it or not,
people have
do.
Done that?
Yes. Well, did you get my pitch? And I'm like, I have not gotten to my email yet. So be patient. I usually try to reply to people who are pitching right away and say, I got your pitch. We'll get back to you in 2 weeks. It's reasonable to, check in after a certain amount of time, but not 4 hours. Another way to lose me in the pitch stage is to use jargon. And some people, I think, especially early career journalists might think that the jargon makes it sound like you know what you're talking about. What it tells me is that you don't know how to translate what you're talking about to my audiences. So I would flip that around. You want the good pitch, bad pitch?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, if you, well, you don't have to read the whole thing. But
I won't read the whole thing, but I'll just give you an example. And this is a real live pitch. It was not written by anybody in this room. I can guarantee you that because it came from a different continent.
Well, you never know. We have international journalists.
So we do, but I'm pretty if this is your pitch, raise your hand. Okay. The subject line was, in all capital letters, so that it would, like, scare me and sound like you were yelling at me, potential ideas. I wish to let you know that I'm currently attending a name of a conference. There are a lot of important topics in this meeting discussed by a wide range of global scientists and experts. I know you're a busy person, but I thought you might want to look at the program that I'm attaching. This is a real pitch to this message. There could be some topics of interest to your readers. Please do let me know if this is something you might be interested in. I hope to hear from you shortly. I'm not going to do your homework for you. Your job is to come up with this story and convince me that it's one we want
to
write.
So did you reply to that pitch?
I said, how about if you go to the conference and let me know if anything catches your eye?
Nice.
Is that helpful?
Yes,
okay.
Great.
So, and I'm, beyond that, I'm really looking forward to your questions. I'd be happy to answer any specifics about how editors work.
Did you say there's a good one as well?
I can read the beginning of the good pitch,
that'd be
too.
Great.
This could have been written by someone in this room, but I don't think so. The header on the email was pitch, colon, schooling children in sustainable futures. So in just a few words, it kind of gave me an idea. What is this about? Starts out with a quote. I believe that children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Whitney Houston captured people's hearts the world over when she belted out this classic, a little more. And then the next paragraph, taking up the gauntlet, pioneering schools are recognizing the importance of educating children in sustainable futures so they don't walk in our shadow. So it was very clear to me in about three sentences what this was about, whether or not it's something that's right for us. There are a lot of considerations beyond whether it's a good pitch or not. But at least I know you know what you're talking about. The next paragraph went on to quote a potential source. So this person had done some backgrounding already. So I knew that they were doing their homework.
Great. So Nancy and Rachel, I wanted to get your perspective on, I know that there's a lot of publications out there that are new, and I was wondering, I wanted to get your perspectives on just new outlets for freelancers. I mean, if you can suggest maybe outlets or publications people may not have heard of, aside from like the New York Times, because it's hard to get accepted by the New York Times if you're not really seasoned. So either one of you want to go first on that? And
well, definitely pitch Mary. She's amazing.
She is.
Yeah, I've worked with her on a number of times, and I also feel like some environmental journalists haven't heard of you guys, which is surprising to me, so pitch them. The Revelator, John Platt's website, is also a new outlet. They're looking for places. They pay more.
Well, certainly Undark, if you haven't heard of that one, it's out of the MIT Science Journalism Program. It was started, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. They pay $1 a word, which is pretty good. And the thing with them is they're looking for where science and society connect, so it has to have that. Can't just be a straight environmental story. You have to have a sociological part to it. Trying to think of others.
Some other classic ones that aren't new but are great, especially if you're starting out a little bit and you have some sort of specialized expertise to environment, would be Manga Bay and Yale's E360.
If somebody's just starting out and they may not pay as well, but they're very eager to, you know, to run your work and, you know, you'd be a good starting place that either of you can think of?
Well, I think definitely Manga Bay and The Revelator, because I don't think they pay as well as some of the other publications. I mean, years ago, a friend who was a more seasoned journalist said, don't write anything for less than $1 a word, which I have to say is, it should really be, I mean, that was the going rate in the late 80s. It's pretty bad. I don't think that's really sustainable, but that seems to be, based on the pitch slam, like the acceptable rate But some places, I don't think the Revelator pays that much. I don't know. I haven't written for them. But yeah, if you're new and you want to hustle, like Rachel, and really get a lot of pieces out, those are, you know, those are great places to get started.
Great. I wanted to also ask both of you about developing your personal brand, because for me, my freelancing really turned around when I started using LinkedIn. I have over 3,000 connections on LinkedIn, and I find a lot of work that way. I'm just wondering, you know, what's the best way to use your social media channels? How do you broaden your, are there certain things that you do to really let people know who you are, so maybe they even come to you and assign you stories, that sort of thing?
I actually don't use LinkedIn very often, but that's really awesome to hear. I think I've only gotten one story ever from LinkedIn. It was an editor from Audubon who found me. I tweet, basically. I should be better about it. But I feel like most of my connections just come from coming to conferences like this and meeting people, especially after hours. I go to a lot of meetups in New York to just meet people one-on-one for drinks and pick people's brains about what they want, what they're looking for in pitches. And I do feel like that personal contact, especially in the beginning, is really important, because they're going to actually open your email and read it and hopefully respond.
And do you have any thoughts about how do you get work? How do people find you, or how do you find them?
Yeah, and I would love to hear how you found work on LinkedIn.
But I'm happy to talk about that.
Yeah, I wish I did better with personal branding. So I'm in a really different situation than Rachel. I live in the middle of the country. I don't come across a lot of editors. That's one reason I totally agree. Go to the conferences, go to both this one and NASW to meet other editors and make those connections. But I'll also say that I have had relationships with editors, several that lasted years, and I never ever met them face to face. So you don't have to do that. But yeah, of course, it's fantastic if you could meet an editor for a drink and pick their brain. That's incredible. And that's a huge advantage of living in New York City. But on the flip side of that, I will say that I live in a part of the country that's really undercovered in terms of environmental reporting. And one thing I try to do, I'm also, I'm at a completely different stage of life than Rachel. I have children, and if anybody in here is wondering about juggling it with kids, I can't really tell from you guys, but I just want to give a shout out to that, because it's really challenging, and I think we're kind of underrepresented in journalism. But anyway, I'm very tied to Cincinnati. It's not easy for me to get away. But so I try to find local stories that have a national impact, and it's surprising how it's not that hard to do that. I found a farmer in the middle of Ohio, about an hour away from me, who was just a superstar in storing carbon in his soil, and he was so good at it that the French government came out before COP21 to see his farm, and then they invited him out to France. I was really bummed I didn't meet him before he went to France, because I had these fantasies of going with him and seeing this guy in his overalls walking through Paris. But so that was really, like, he was really amazing, and he was like this average guy in the middle of the country. I'm trying to sell another story. If any of you are at the pitch slam of a deer control project in Cincinnati, where they're removing the deer's ovaries, sterilizing them, and the guy who does it is like the superstar in this field, and he's got a huge project in Staten Island that he's also doing, but he's also doing it in my backyard. And so there's, if you look around, if you read your local paper, if there is one, or talk to local scientists at your local university, you might be able to find a story that people on the coast aren't going to have easy access to. So that's the good side of that.
And you're very busy. So how do you find story ideas, and how do you get work? I mean, you mentioned the meetups, but like, how do you find stories, and how do you come up with story ideas?
Well, I'm coming out of this book writing process, which has been just my life for the last year. But I feel like a lot of the work I'm doing now is tied to the book, to things that I heard about in reporting, to things people are emailing me now, which that might not be so relevant for a lot of people in this room. Normally, I get all of the press releases, I get Eureka Alert, and in the morning I go through those looking for something that might be interesting as a news story for one of the people I look for or work for. When I do interviews, I'm always thinking of bigger picture, like could this be a feature? Could this one interesting little detail lead to another story? Editors also come to me with work. I think probably about like 30 to 40% of what I do is things that people bring to me and say, will you do this? And I usually say yes as long as it's monetarily makes sense and or is interesting. So it's press releases, it's talking to people, and it's just always having your eye out for a potential story. Like when I go out to eat, if I find a cool sushi restaurant and they tell me about a Brazilian guy who's growing shrimp in his basement and that's where they get their shrimp, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to pitch that. That's an actual thing.
Did you pitch that?
It's on my list of things to do. I chronically do have this giant list of pitches to come, and the shrimp guy is at the top, and I'm going to do it.
So, Mary, I wanted to ask you, we had talked a bit about this, about how do you really, once the piece is published, how do you boost your visibility and editor's appreciation? If you want to talk a bit about some things about that, how do you sort of, you know, again, getting to this idea of personal brand?
Absolutely. Thank you. And I'm just going to expand on that just a little bit and say, once you have connected with an editor, how do you keep that relationship going? How do you build a relationship that where then I'm going to be the person who comes to you and says, will you write this for me? Which most of our content is generated. There are ideas that we generate, and we do look for people to contribute. So I think the most important thing is to really deliver good work. Be a good writer. There are many ways that you can improve that. You all know what the hints are. One of the pieces of advice that we give is read a lot of fiction, because really narrative is so important, especially for stories with a big technical angle for our audiences. If you have a specialty area, if there's an area, well, similar to what Rachel's talking about with her book. She's done a lot of work on taking with the CITES and the different kinds of endangered animals. If you have that specialty, let us know about that, and let us know that you've got a lot of background in that, because chances are you'll become my go-to person for that. A big part for us is with NCR, our content is all Creative Commons licensed, which means that it can be republished by other outlets. So one thing that really endears our contributors to us is to have you help share our story with other outlets. I would say, really build up your social media and then use your social media to help promote the things that you have produced. It's going to catch the eye of other editors, and the editors you're working with and you're helping that story get out is really valuable also. So anything you can do to do that, if you're willing and interested to do radio interviews on the topic that you've written about, I think that's also very beneficial. Other things that you can do just in general to have an editor want to work with you again, some of them sound really basic, and I would have thought they were basic too until I ran into so many people like not doing them. If you're given an assigned length, contribute something of that length unless you check in with your editor. If you're given a specific assignment, follow the assignment. Don't, all of a sudden have the story take you in a different direction and sort of have this surprise package on your deadline. That doesn't work. Other things I think that are really helpful, there are just small things that can be really valuable. This is not a small thing, but fact check your work. If you got the names wrong, how are we going to know you got anything right? And then there are just very small things that can make you the go-to person. Things like voluntarily offering to help identify sources for visuals to go with your piece. If you notice that whatever outlet you're writing for uses subheads, putting subheads into your contribution. Small things like that can make somebody want to work with you again.
Great. I'm happy to share my LinkedIn tip, even though I'm a moderator and I'm not supposed to be like commenting on content. But I what I do is I get the, if any of you are on LinkedIn, you probably get the notices about people who are like switching jobs or, you know, moving into new positions. And just a story that I'll tell about this is that what I do is I find those people, if it's a publication that I want to write, for. And by the way, I only will, most of my connections are editors. Like if you want to, you know, connect with me, I'll connect with you because you're a freelancer, but there's really not much to me to be gained to like connect with another freelancer who's as hungry as I am. So I connect with a lot of editors, and then when one is moving into a position, I will connect with them and send them a quick note saying, I'm really interested in contributing to your publication. Can you send me your email? I'll send you some clips. And then I do that if they respond, which they almost usually do right away. And then I send them some clips, tell them my areas of expertise, how I'm very interested. And I do, you know, learn about their publication. I flatter them. Always wanted to write for your publication. And I did this one time just to give you an example of the value of what you do if you connect with an editor who's new to their job is they're looking for their own roster of freelancers. And so I had this other editor I did that with, and she was with Good Housekeeping, and I was a health-related beat, or health or parenting. And I reached out to her, and we connected, and she said, I had all these, and then they'll say, send me your ideas. So I sent her a bunch of ideas. She liked one idea quite a bit. She said, do some research on it, come with a more fully pitch. I basically could have written the whole article. And then after I did all that work, she said, oh, sorry, no. And there's always a danger, by the way, they can take that material and assign it to a staff writer, which has happened. I pitched a couple other things. She said, keep pitching. I pitched a couple other things. Never worked out. She left, and then I saw that a new person took her job. And so I immediately reached out to her on LinkedIn, and she said, oh, your timing's perfect. I want to do some really hard-hitting, investigative, like deep work. And I said, I have this idea on suicide prevention in schools. She said, I love it. I did it for her, and we had a great relationship. And that usually gets me off and running at a lot of publications. And you can just do a search on LinkedIn of editors at blah, blah, blah publication, and you can just connect with them. So for me, LinkedIn has been, I haven't gotten that many, you said you haven't gotten many assignments through LinkedIn. No one's come to me just like out of the blue, but it's me sort of going after them. And I also will mention that all of these guys have been really successful at just doing environment, but I cover everything. I cover retirement, aging, parenting, education, science, health, technology, environment, everything pretty much except real estate and sports, which if I had to, I would. It wouldn't be my preference. The other thing I wanted to ask you, just sort of a housekeeping thing, is that I'm curious, because I struggle with this. You're juggling a lot of things. If any of you, you included, can suggest a way to keep track of it for invoices, is there a standard? I came upon this automated system where they automatically send the invoice when it's due, but every publisher has a different perspective, you know, different way of handling that. So I'm just wondering if you have suggestions about good, maybe online tools for handling the business side, and then we might have Genevieve pitch in at this point too.
So I just use an old school Excel spreadsheet. I have a page for each month. The top, it's like outlets, assignment, fee, date filed, date paid, and at the end of the month, I just highlight everything in yellow, and then as I get paid, I unhighlight them. And about once a month, I go through the past months and see, who hasn't paid me in 3 months. And then I send them an email being like, please pay me. And it works really well. It's really simple. I also have a spreadsheet at the very end where I keep track of the average I make each month. And I have a little graph that shows me how I'm doing compared to past years.
I'm really horribly disorganized, so I don't do anything. I mean, I do have an Excel spreadsheet. I've gotten better, and I do have just a numbering system, which is just the year, like 2018 dash for each outlet, 1, 2, 3, 4. Those are my invoice numbers, so I can keep track of them, if that makes sense. I think there are some invoice services, and some of them are free, but it's true every place has a different kind of way they want you to invoice, so I haven't done any of those. I just wanted to interject one thing. This is kind of businessy. When we were talking about pay, and it occurred to me that that, because I've had this discussion with some other friends, other journalists, is that one, hopefully Mary won't disagree, but it's always worth asking for more money when the editor says, you know, this is what the payment is. Always go back and ask for a little bit more. And
totally agree.
Yeah, and especially, no offense to the men in the room, but especially women, because there's definitely been instances of male journalists, freelancers getting paid more. And I don't know if that's just because they're more aggressive than women, but we need to be aggressive too, or assertive, I guess is the right word. And one other really good tool, I'm sure you guys all know about this, is, and maybe y'all do too, but there's, sorry, this is just for the women in the room, but there are these binders full of Facebook pages. So there's one for science writers. There's a bazillion of them. But those are great places just to, editors get on them sometimes, and you can ask people for help with sources or, you know, a million things, or you can just say, hey, I published this great article. Would you put it out on social media? So, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. I'm notoriously bad at negotiating. I just did it, though, a couple days ago because this employer was offering me they had found me through another editor at their publication, and they were paying me half of what that person had paid me at the same publication. And I said, wow, why is there a difference? I mean, it was an easy one. And she said, oh, because ours is for the web. But then she said, I realized that I really want you to do this piece, and I know it's a quick turnaround, so I will give you $300 more. And I thought, wow, I can actually negotiate. I usually don't, but I will shame editors who are paying obscenely low. Like some people come to me and they say, yeah, we'd love you to do it, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, how much are you paying me? And it'll be like, I don't know, $300 or $400. And I'll use that as an opportunity as somebody who's senior who can afford not to take the work to say, this is an unfair amount of money and you shouldn't be paying this to anyone. Maybe somebody who's very junior and who's never published before might find this acceptable, but I feel it's my duty to inform you that that's an exploitative wage. And I really, because I have nothing to lose. I have nothing to lose. And I think we need to do more of this. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's no transparency, and you might want to weigh in on this from an editor's perspective, there's no transparency in what these publications pay. And they will always assign you things, often, not always, but often will assign you a piece without telling you how much they're going to pay. And then you're like, yeah, I'll do it, but how much are you paying? So it's just a huge pet peeve of mine. And I feel like we need to ask for more, but we also need to have it be more transparent. If you look up pay rate for such and such a publication on Google or whatever, you won't find it. Mm-hmm. It's very, you know, or they'll say, well, we'll see. It's on a case-by-case basis or something. So I don't know what your experience is negotiating with people. Or, weren't the person who didn't put the pay in. You did. So no shaming there.
I'll add the editor's 2 cents worth, so to speak. Yes, we in some cases do negotiate. I do have to say it's a lot easier to negotiate if you've worked with us before and we know what you're going to give us. There are some things, some stories that we get that by the time we're done with them, we may have just well have written them ourselves. And when that happens, you know, you're not quite worth as much to us as someone else where maybe we're taking out the double spaces and correcting a little bit of the grammar. So part of it is, yes, prove yourself to be an invaluable source, as you had with that one that you negotiated. We are starting to look at differential pay rates for people who have not contributed to our outlet before versus those that that have credentials with us. But we don't have our pay rate on our website just because that's something that gets doesn't allow us to be situational enough, but our general rate for people that we've worked with before is $1 an hour. And we're a nonprofit publication. I'm not going to make excuses, but we have
a dollar word, not a dollar now.
I'm sorry, dollar word.
that would be exploitative. I would have
back in the day. No, that's okay. Yes, I'm being editor shamed now. Thank you. I'm sorry, a dollar word, and that is sort of with people that we have worked with before.
Now, Genevieve, did you want to? So she approached me after this started because she has some really good advice about small business, like viewing this as a small business. Yeah.
So I'm an editor of Mongrain, and I've been in that job 2 years, and I would like to share a very short expert about something that relates to this race, and I hope this will stick in your mind, especially with women. I have the ability to decide what I pay to each individual contributor out of my own budget, and each editor along the way is like that. So that's why our race is here. I tend to pay on the high end because I came from the freelance world and it's beautiful. After Me Too started happening, women started speaking up more, so my thinking started changing about certain things, even though I'm totally a feminist my whole life, obviously. And I had this thought, I went back and I looked at the rates that I've been paying my freelancers. And I'm not joking. Every woman, freelancer, where would be their rates? They were being paid 20 to 30 cents less a word. Not because I did it on purpose, because they don't ask and they're too fucking apologetic all the time. Every time I get an email from a female correspondent who has a freelancer, they almost always apologize for something. It's not necessary. You can be polite and not be apologetic. And obviously I fixed the rates, but I was really shocked. You know, I mean, at myself. How could I have not noticed? And it's all this, we're saying case-by-case basis, feel or not, which experience you have. Okay, that was the matrix I was using too. But the end result was still that the women were paid less on the dollar. And 20 to 30 cents, the exact same amount that we see, you know, 70 cents on the dollar. So I think it's really on the freelancers. They are very aware. There are some websites that have like posted anonymous rates. You know, you can say, oh, people freelancers say this and I think it's as much, but it's kind of reliable. So and then was there like a small business?
Yeah, you were saying that you have some advice about small, you know, if you're running it, you run it as a small business and
yeah, I mean, I think the small business aspect, like each of the people on this panel, especially Rachel is not the typical, like, you really have it nailed down.
I love asking for more money. It's like this delightful game.
Wow. Me.
Yeah. Not everybody. I think it's really important to remember the business aspect. Not everybody is a journalist. In fact, quite a few of us, I would say the majority of us, are not small business entrepreneurs necessarily. We don't think of ourselves like that first and foremost. You are an enterprise of one, and where you work. You're the accountant, you're the bookkeeper, you're the travel agent, you're the HR person, you're having a hard time, like you have to decide how to help yourself. You have to do all this stuff, and you have to manage your health and your well-being, your family, your whole mental balance. And I think that that's a big reason why a lot of investors have a hard time with longevity in your next, because it just gets so hard. And then you want to
I just want to say really quickly, and I think that was great. One thing that I think is really helpful is to have a support group. Find some other freelancers. I have a group where we just email each other. We have email chats, and we live all around the country. A couple of them I've never met in person, and that's huge. In fact, I had an issue with an editor recently, I was incredibly stressful, and I went to this group first after I cried for a bit. And they were fantastic, and one of them said, be a man. This is what you say. Don't back down. And it was great advice. And, you know, freelancing can be, especially if you're in my situation, very, very lonely. You're sitting by yourself a lot unless you go out or you go to a co-working space, which is a great idea. I walk my dogs a lot, so I run into my neighbors. But, you know, you got to do things to get some personal support. And I think having a group like that, especially with different perspectives, you can get them to read your pitches, all kinds of things. It's just, and you meet them at conferences like this typically.
And I would second that. I'm in a group that I was invited to join. It's a science writers group, but it's made up of media relations people at the University of Michigan where I live, as well as science writers people, again, who do this full time. And I have gotten, we bounce ideas off of each other, we air grievances, and I've also gotten lots of stories from the media relations people, really good gigs. And so, again, if it's possible to have, you know, maybe even start a meetup in your community, I think that can be really valuable. All right, we want to allow lots of time for questions, so we're going to open this up. Even though I'm moderator, I'm happy to chime in as well. I've been, as I said, I write for like, I don't know, 50 different publications, and I've been doing it for a long time. So the rules follow as always, SEJ members and journalists first. So please say your name and title and just ask away.
Hi, I'm Lugar Zach. I'm a freelance writer from Minneapolis. Given the idea of being able to write a great pitch, I know how to do that, I've done that. What I'm finding now is as I try to get into new publications where it's the first time I do my research, I check audiences, get to the founders if they've written about it before, I do all that research, I spend a couple of hours doing what I think is a solid pitch. I find out who the editor is, I send it off, and it's either. So are you following up with telephone calls? Are you finding people's names on Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn and saying, hey, you know, I introduced myself, here's my pitch? I try not to take it personally that, okay, they don't think my work is good or whatever. But man, it's tough when you spend time crafting a pitch and it just disappears. So is there any advice on how to manage that or how to do multiple editors at the same publication or how do you break in so that at least you get a this is good or bad?
Yeah, that is one of the most annoying things that happens to me too, and it makes me averse to trying new publications if I don't have an in. So oftentimes what I'll do is I will find out who I know who's written for that publication, if I know anyone, so that they can give me an intro. I will track that editor down at a conference to get some FaceTime, tweet at them, get some kind of interaction, because it's definitely a problem. I really think a lot of, especially the higher outlets, they just won't respond to you unless they know you. It's annoying. It gets me down. I go to the gym, but I try to have a personal rule that if I haven't heard back from someone in a few weeks or a month, I'll turn the pitch. I'm not going to let that pitch go to waste. I'm going to find a home for it. Likewise, if I get a no, I'm like, okay, who else can I pitch this to? Oftentimes I'll have like three or four places already in mind.
So you don't do multiple submissions?
No, I don't do multiple submissions at once. I've been told through the years it's a no-no. That topic recently came up for discussion on one of these Facebook groups, and I found out that some people do that, especially for breaking news, but I don't write very much breaking news.
And, you know, I should just say to you, if I can chime in, that editors are ridiculously busy. I'm not saying that to excuse them, but I am relentless. So I not after 4 hours, but within a week, I will follow up. I never call them, but I will email them. And then I had this one who was for Prevention Magazine. It was, again, not an environmental piece. It was about what you should tell people who are mourning a loss, like the right thing to say. It was not a complex topic. And she didn't respond. And like a couple months went by, and I kept pinging her. And finally she responded and said, yes, let's do this. I'm like, great, you know, how many words, deadline, but nothing. So 2 months went by, 3 months went by, 4 months went by, 5 months went by. And I thought, oh, I just came across her name. I'll just ping her again. She's like, yeah, let's do this. It was six months went by. And I did do the story for her. But sometimes they're just busy and they're inundated and you're not their priority. So, yep.
Okay.
Yes, tell me your name.
Just my name is Saul Chess. I'm a freelancer, SJ member from Toronto. There's been a double standard in sense with that I've always noticed. Mm-hmm. On one hand, we're worried about bothering the editor. You know, we wait a week, we wait 5 months, whatever. I'm curious if text is the respected etiquette, and why not the phone? On the other hand, when we're dealing with sources, we're waiting 5 months for an answer, we're going to file the stories. Is there possibly an expectation of editors and an appreciation for the writer who is persistent and just gets back the next day?
Do you ever text your editors? Like, not editors you don't know? I'm just curious.
I don't know if you would have their...
I've never done
you'd
that.
Need their cell phone number, right?
Yeah, you'd need their cell phone number, and they don't make that available usually, do they, so easily?
No. But I do know people that will call after hours because they don't want to make the editor mad, but they'll leave a voicemail. So that's a technique. And I don't know how you feel about this, Mary, but I actually use email that has tracking software in it, so I can just see if somebody opened my email. Now, some people in my writer's group didn't like that idea, but it makes me feel better that at least I know they opened it. And then, because it could get lost in their email very easily. So that's why you should always check back at least once before you move on.
Speaking for our outlet, we do get back to anyone who sends us a pitch.
Nice.
Yeah, it's just
very
it's
much appreciated.
To me, it's just a matter of ethics. Yeah. It's just respect. Mm-hmm. So I would say don't, again, not the four-hour rule. But if you don't hear from me in a week, sometimes spam filters catch things. Sometimes, like I said, I have accidentally thrown away a pitch or two. Fine to come back. I would say by email, though. If somebody texted me after sending a pitch and not hearing back, I wouldn't take that well.
Yeah. Other questions? Tell me your name.
Nancy Andrews, and also put a pitch.
Yeah.
I'm the Melissa Patterson Foundation fellow, and so this is the deadline. It's October 1st, but it's worth your time. There will be $20,000 grants.
Oh, great. Thank you for mentioning
that. Great. So I have two questions. One, I want to know what the guy said to get the 20 to 30% more. I mean, if you recall, what are those arguments? And the other thing is, on the same vein of money, you've been talking about words, but I also do photography and audio, and you know, lots of times people just want that free. Or you know, how do you price that? Or what if that's your main thing? So two questions. One person.
So ask me the question again. What are those guys, what did you recall that in general men would be paid for 20 to 30 cents more per word? What do you think? Do you know what they ask for? Like, how did they just make that disbelieve their title to be paid? That's all. This is just disbelieve they're doing a job, they're entitled to be paid for it.
So if you said I'm just going to pay 1,000 units, they just want to have, you said, well, I really need 1,300.
If that's the case. It's just business.
Yeah. So, but Genevieve, to interrupt you, so what was his language? Like, that's what I'm curious.
That's like every male contributor. It's not one person.
No, but what did they say? They like, well, I'm sorry, that's not acceptable. I need X more. Like, what is the language?
Bump the price up a little bit on this.
Okay.
So it wasn't very specific. It was just general.
It's a negotiation. It's really important to remember when you're emailing with the editor, you're in a negotiation. The second that they respond to you, and you want to do everything you can to keep that conversation going, because they don't, if you ever got an assignment and then you never heard from the editor again, does that ever happen to anybody? We're like, yeah, I got this assignment. And it's always like some publication you always want to write for. And then the conversation just dies on the vine. And you don't get the assignment. And it's a negotiation. You're negotiating your time and your focus. And they just ask. The people who get paid more are just the ones that are like, they approach it as a business. If they're in business, they need to make enough money so that they're not taking the minimum wage. I have one example. This team that did some investigative reporting for us last year, they did the work and then they went back and calculated the time. And they said that it was a minimum wage job for 2 months. And they said, we want to do that. And they asked for double. So it's a negotiation business.
Are you saying males are more aggressive, or is it more that females are not aggressive enough?
I think that this is just my one person's opinion, basically. I think that women are just dealing with more, there's just more on their mind, they're dealing with more at home, they're dealing with more, and I'm not saying that men's heads are empty at all, I don't mean like that. I think women are dealing with just a huge list of things that I can't even go into that men don't even know about. I mean, and it could be something like relationships are a great example of a way to just ruin your freelance career. If you get into a bad relationship, I'm not joking. If I had anything to do over again, any advice, especially for people who are like young and married, be really careful about relationships because you're in business for yourself, and anything that distracts you from what you need to do and how you need to do it. I mean, how do you think Rachel managed to? Oh, I went to this place and I did this. That was the New York Times and this and that. Because she's approaching it with business, right? She's, and I think, men and women who were just really to be dealing with a lot of stuff. Interesting. It's just physical, and then emotional. And
sorry, let's go to you, and then you next. So, yeah, just say your name and your...
Yeah, I'm Hillary Sloan. I'm freelance in California, Southern California. Just wanted to add something I heard years ago that I think is perfect. I once asked a man, how did he learn to make money? And he said, I never knew I couldn't.
Except jogging at night, right?
Yeah.
Who, the women here think jogging at night is like a lot of from the...
Yeah.
Coming from a different place, but
doesn't
mean that we have to
let
money.
Go ahead. So tell us your name.
My name's David. I'm an attorney completing my teach.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have to prioritize journalists first.
So. I'm a member.
I'm sorry. I got flagged for this, so I want to make sure. Go ahead.
This is incredibly random. Believe it or not, Omarosa from Trump and Apprentice fame, a few years ago, she wrote a book called Bitch Switch, and she discusses this very topic. I actually read it. She's from my hometown. And the premise is that women don't make as much through their own fault because they don't negotiate. And what the issue here has nothing to do with whether you're a man or a woman. It has to do with whether or not you have a place of value on your own time. I'm an attorney. I'm not working for $50 an hour. I'm working for $300 an hour. And so it has nothing to do with your background or who you are. You have to value your own time, seize your own control, seize your own destiny, and determine what's worth it for you. Some people who are starting out are willing to do something for a little less. They're trying to get clips and build a reputation. At Rachel's level, Rachel is awesome. I hire Rachel in a minute, but she's a bit old, and she's going to get what she deserves, and you know, she has a value on her time. So it really is about treating it like a business, treating it like your livelihood, treating it like your career, and doing what you got to do to reach that level that makes you happy. There's a lot of people who'd be willing to work for less. It's a hobby, whatever. They feel like they're making a difference, a contribution to a society, whatever. It's the same with people who run for public office. Am I willing to do this awful job where everybody hates me for X amount of money? Personal choices. So we should realize that you're in control of your own destiny, the very power of your man, woman, or Martian.
Yeah, good point. Anybody else? Tell me your name.
My name is Laura Carroll. I'm a freelance writer and documentary filmmaker. And my question is around one of the things I found hard was finding the right female actors for editors.
That's such a good question. That's the other reason I use LinkedIn. Because LinkedIn, you can't get to them except going through LinkedIn. Oh, I'm sorry. She asked, how do you get the right email address for editors, and especially women's magazines? So for a while, there was a formula, like the New York Times. It was first initial, last name at mytimes.com. Then they don't have a formula anymore, and they used to do that at women's magazines. So that's another reason I reach out to them at LinkedIn. I'll say, can you give me your email? So I find them there. I connect with them. I ask for their email. But I don't know if you guys have other thoughts about that.
Do you have a professional account? LinkedIn?
Yeah, it's not a person. I mean, yeah.
It's not the free one.
Oh, it's free. Yeah, okay. No, I don't. Yeah. Do you guys have other suggestions on that, or thoughts about that, or?
It's a good one. I mean, I usually just pitch people that I've met or I have gotten the email address through a back channel. So.
Like, what is her
Yeah, I feel like it's just...
Sometimes I just Google variations of their name with the publication until I see it pop up in my feed as their email.
And sometimes you can just say so-and-so's email, and it will come up sometimes. Did you have a question?
Yes,
go ahead, Terry.
My name is Sam. I'm a journalism student at Central Michigan University.
Oh, great. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. So as a young person, I was going to get my youthful vulnerability club the room for a second. I apologize. But I do get a bit nervous to think about freelancing because I'm not yet as well networked as I would like to be. There's still so many things I'm learning, so many things I feel like I'm not yet prepared for. What do you think are the best first steps that a young person should always keep in mind upon graduating college?
Good question. I teach journalism, so I'm happy to chime in, but I want to keep hugging if you guys have
it. I guess the first thing to keep in mind is it's not going to just start. It's going to be really, really slow at first, and you're going to want to find a part-time client to get you through those months or even years. So when I first started, I maybe made like $500 a month freelancing. It was really bad. But I had a two-day-a-week gig with Autism Speaks. I wasn't interested in autism, really, but it was something I could do to pay my bills. I knew I could make rent every month and then build up those clips. So be patient, but it will work if you put in the effort, and I'm sure you're going to be good at it if you want to.
And you have a great journalism program there, so that's great you're doing it. I just want to also add, to the extent that you can, it's great that you're here. I mean, you're taking the first step, right?
Exactly.
SCJ has a mentorship program. They're really great. You should become very involved in that. Also, do what you can for free to get experience and make connections. So, for example, I worked in Washington, D.C. for several years. I moved back to the Detroit area, or to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I always wanted to learn public radio, but I was, like, in my late 20s at that time, so I connected with my local public radio station, and I said, can I just volunteer for a day a week, and can you train me how to do radio? And then they not only trained me, but then I was on the air, and then there was an environmental network that just sprung up in my town, and I started doing radio on the air. So you never know where that will lead, and like just find opportunities people are always interested in. And there's also internships that aren't even just, you know, some are paid. And also you're in a situation where if you can find someone, even if they won't pay you really well, just to get the clips, it's great. There's so many outlets there for free. They just want clips because I know because they asked me to write for free too, so I know they exist. Yes.
If I can just add to that briefly, I'd like to put in a plug for the NCM Mentor Program. Mm. Some of you have maybe participated in that.
Oh,
what we do is it's a one-story relationship with a seasoned environmental journalist. We have a place on our website where you basically fill out a Google form with a story idea. If we like your idea, we will assign the story to you, and we will also assign you a mentor who very often is somebody who has written for us previously. That person will work with you one-on-one to produce a story for ANSIA. We pay the mentor, we pay the mentee. And this is our way of responding to that sort of catch-22 of not being able to get clips because you don't have clips. I have cards up here about that and happy to talk to you about it as well.
Oh, just one more thing. The Pulitzer Center also does a very similar program to yours, which I didn't know about. That's awesome.
Oh, there you go.
So look
and,
that up.
I'm sorry.
I'll just say super quick that I started out working for daily newspapers, and I know those jobs are disappearing quickly, but that to me was really invaluable experience, just learning how to get the facts right, how to approach people, and I got to learn from people that were more experienced than me, so I'm grateful I had that training. If you could get that for a couple years, that could be a really good way to get started, and then you can move into freelancing when you feel more confident.
Yes, back in, way in the back. Wait, could you say your name? And
my name is Jake Sims. I'm a freelance writer. Starting out, I think there's still a fair amount of number of jobs in business journalism, places like Bloomberg, Dow Jones, Eaton Journal. I mean, perhaps in Tokyo, they hire people straight out of college or right out of school. So, and that's a good basis because almost all the issues that we look at, there's a financial and business angle, and like regulatory angle, and you're basically following money. Why it's not being done well because of, you know, business interests or sort of government finances. Another thing, I guess looking at, there's a thing called ADAS, which I don't know if people have heard of, but it's for freelancers, you can sign up, and they will send stories, send jobs to you, and they'll make sure you get paid. So that's one thing. I've gotten several jobs in Tokyo, different things from big state to TV story, to even like financial research. So I mean, given the business background, I have to do a lot of things as a financial person, as a journalist. I mean, I do research sometimes for investors. I've done stuff, I guess, for sort of former PR. I think Julie mentioned that earlier about doing, I think, medical.
Yeah.
You have to wear a lot of hats. I find it hard to actually become full-time freelance. I have to do other things in order to sort of make ends meet. So okay. That's just my two cents.
Other questions? Yes?
Hi, my name is Sarah. I work with Lake Geofestival tonight. I'm curious about the interesting barrier panel for women.
Yeah, and that's my bad. I should have had a man on here. It just didn't occur to me.
No, I thought that was great. One of the things I'm curious about is, do you guys have any hard past ways of staying safe while traveling?
That's your question.
Related to that, medical insurance, especially overseas.
Yeah, repeat the question so they can.
Yes, so how do you stay safe when you travel? I've traveled by myself across Asia and Africa. I guess the most dangerous would have been Chad. And I just do the same thing I would anywhere. I just, don't walk by yourself at night if it seems sketchy. I don't take any extra precautions. I would love to take a training course in combat situations, because that's definitely a skill I lack. And I've never got an emergency insurance. Maybe I should have, but it did come with the Pulitzer Crisis Grant. So if you get one of those, you automatically get it.
Yes.
Just a quick follow-up to the service. ACOS is a really great training sort of safety guide. And I never even did that training as well.
What was the question?
ACOS is the ACOS Alliance. They're looking at women's safety. And then International Women's Media Foundation, I never even did that training. Both of those are really great organizations.
I mean, I guess the bottom line is there is always going to be risk for men or women. If I had been Kim Wall, I would have gotten on that submarine for that poor freelancer who got murdered. Just, you can't completely eliminate the risk. It's just something you have to balance.
Oh, wait. I just want to get somebody who hasn't asked a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm Meg. I'm a freelancer in the Boston area. Okay. That's Julie. I think you're the one that mentioned the medical
writing.
How did you get into
it? Oh, yeah. So this is... So she'd asked about medical writing. So I live near the University of Michigan. I teach at the University of Michigan. And universities have an incredible array of their own publications, especially the larger the school, the more the publications. So I just contacted the editor of every single one of the publications, and I did a face-to-face with some of them. And we talk about, crossing the line into, PR, but I went to this university. I think they are doing some incredible things in terms of research. I feel like my reporting hasn't been compromised in any way. I did a lot for medical breakthrough type stories for Michigan Medicine, which is one of their publications. I've written for the Michigan Alumnus. I just did a huge piece on food insecurity on campus. And I did a huge piece on mental health on campus and the ways the university is responding to that. And then I've written for probably, I wrote for their science publication. So if there's a natural resource publication, department of your school, chances are they have a publication. So and that's been a great source. They pay respectably well. They're very easy to work with. And the bigger the school, the more publications. So chances are you can find some sort of niche. And again, that comes to just reaching out to them. Getting in contact with the editors. A lot of times they take freelancers. So yeah.
Yeah, and just to quickly add to that,
right?
Yeah, I do that as well. And my oldest daughter is going off to college next year. And a year ago, we were doing some college visits, And because I try to focus on big research universities because I know they're going to pay and have the biggest need. And we went to the University of Chicago. And so just along with that trip, I just emailed the director of, or the communications, the magazine editor, I'm sorry. And I introduced myself and sent a few clips and asked if I could meet her for coffee while we were there. And that was great. It was very fruitful. I've gotten some assignments from them. So
you don't have to have gone to that school to get the work?
No. I don't actually. I've written a little for my, I went to the University of Colorado, but actually, no, I do more for like big schools like Columbia University. I haven't done Harvard, but Chicago. Big research schools are the good ones to hit for that.
My name is Max Schultz. I'm a student journalist at the University of Florida. So just sort of breaking into the threshold of Free Magazine, but I feel as if there's you need to sort of have a foundation behind you before you can really start establishing yourself in the community. Would you say it's better to have a volume of clips from a broad array of publications, or is it better to have one really quality piece from maybe a more well-known publication? What are your sort of tips on?
Do you want to answer that?
Sure.
I wouldn't make it an either or. I think it's the quality of the piece that you produce that's really going to make the difference. We will look at your clips. And granted, it's hard to tell how much of that you contributed and how much an editor contributed. But if you have several clips, I would say that's more, as a rule, I would say it's the quality of that. Flip side is if you do have something from the New York Times or Scientific American or something like that, we will notice that as well.
Yes.
Tip for the group, if you're a freelancer, I recommend you get an insurance policy to protect yourself.
Yeah.
It only takes one defamation lawsuit or one slapstick lawsuit to really destroy it. I have a $300 policy that gives me $2 million a year of coverage.
Wow.
So if you're your homeowner's insurance or whatever, funds that help, that's the issue. This is a hobby, you might not really take this serious, and you know, who teach you to publish one thing, and somebody doesn't like it, slaps you with a lawsuit. That typical lawsuit is 50 to 100 G's just to. And then people say, oh, I have free speech, I can write whatever. Even if you win, if you're in court or if you're being sued, you're losing.
Do you have that?
Yeah. And also, it's kind of a rule of thumb that when they send you the contract, is to look for an indemnification clause and try and get them to strike that, because otherwise they're sort of putting the onus on you if there's something wrong with the article and you don't have the resources like they do to fight something like that. So you can just, there's lots of people have talked about it online, but you can send it back and say, can we cut out this clause from the contract? And you really should do that.
100% agree on making your indemnification clause either more favorable or getting rid of it altogether. That's what I usually try to do. I'd love to hear more about that after the session, because I've looked into insurance before and it's been prohibitively expensive and seems
to be. Yeah, I would too. If there's any, if you could share that, that'd be great. Yes?
I'd like to maybe stress the importance of something that I've experienced at Toronto, personal meetups and freelancers. Actually, I'm sort of under the kind of auspices of SCJ, nothing official. We've had SCJ members meet up in Toronto.
Oh, cool.
It's, you know, for those of us whose water cooler is so low down in the kitchen, it's really great to build a building. In fact, I don't think I've been a freelancer since the early 90s. There's no way I'd be doing it now. There's also freelancer write-up organizations as well.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, I mean, there are more write-ups, writer meetups in Toronto than I could possibly manage.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's the case in a lot of American communities or what. I have fine food. I've been active in a number of journalism groups as well, the Canadian Association of Journalists, where you inevitably get into mentorship situations. And a couple of things I've noticed on mentorships, which I kind of want to raise here just really briefly. One is it's a two-way street. I find they're often treated as a one-way street, but I think that the person who considers themselves the mentor also has to consider themselves the mentee, if you will. There's an awful lot to learn from people who are just breaking into the business because things change.
Sure.
I'm not as good at, let's say, a technology or maybe even coming up with new ideas or thinking outside the box. It's something new, might be. The other thing I've noticed is the biggest barrier seems to be a lack of self-confidence. But I do get, you know, dealing with a lot of people who come to you because you're running a little chat or something and say, I'm trying to pitch. They come with a lot of questions every day, and I find it's often boiled down to a lack of self-confidence. And it can extend to story pitching. negotiating would be a good one. I found that, well, I think these things did, I found that most often.
Yeah, it seems to be a thing. Yes, we have time for like just a couple more questions, so go ahead. Yeah, sure.
Okay. Hi, I'm Jolie Breeden at the Natural Hazard Center at University of Colorado Boulder. I'm going to ask the related go-to question, how much can we expect to make? I mean, obviously there's a range depending on how your skill level of various factors that we've heard about, but can we characterize just a little bit?
So a few years ago, I did a freelancer survey for NASW, and I'm happy to send you the link, which I published, and it shows at least the range for like 2015, whenever I did this. If you Google show me the money and then my name, you'll find it. It's up there. I've made six figures for every year I've done it except the first and last year because of this book.
Wow, that's impressive. I've made five figures, but I'm not as successful as she is. But in terms of are you looking at overall salary or how much you make per article? I mean,
I'd just be interested in knowing, like, you know, obviously, like, you know, if you're going from being a paid journalist to clearly already have a bias, but like when you're going from you know steady.
Employment.
Or to freelancing.
Yeah,
how did that compare to, you know, your salary as a news reporter to a salary as?
Well, that's incredibly impressive what Rachel's doing. I'm really inspired. Even as a newspaper reporter, my salary is not great. It was fine at the time. It's been quite a number of years since I'd done it, but just for comparison, my goal this year is to make $60,000.
And that's about what I usually make.
Yeah. And I have to say, I'm married. I have another income coming in.
Yeah.
And you have to think, too, that a third of that is going to your taxes. So it's not great money.
No health insurance.
Right.
So it's, you know, Yes.
Just a quick plug for money. I'm with the National Geographic Society. We've got stories about that's
money
to
go
fund
independent
journalists
who
go on projects. Yes? Yeah, Nancy Andrews. Wondering if we could get to the question of pay for other types of content, photos, stories, you know, how that affects
them. Mm-hmm. I don't do photos.
How you handle them.
I definitely always ask for money for photos. At this point, I'm like, I'm not going to just give you photos for free. I've never done audio, though.
Have you?
I made one small video once. It wasn't very good, and I don't even think they used it, which was fine. I do, actually, that's a skill I would really like to learn and do, but I'm not sure that there's a lot of places paying for that, but I don't know. It sounded like Monongahabe does, so... You would think. Sorry.
We have time for one more question. Anybody? Yes.
I'm super interested. Part of my reason I'm doing this conference, I'm mostly interested in talking about different topics that I feel a little bit afraid of. And the big area of interest for me is pairing with reporters at a new level and having their high level of expertise in teaching media with a video.
I'm just going to jump in on that. We just published the question had to do, she's a video journalist, is that correct? And is interested in pairing with somebody who does the word end of things to collaboratively produce a project. We just published a three-piece series on microfiber pollution, and it was exactly that kind of thing, where the writer had pitched the story, but had a videographer that she was working with and pitched it as a package. So, that's entirely doable.
That's so cool.
And I know there's one of these big grant funding places. It might be Pulitzer. They like to see several people apply together with, it might not be Pulitzer, but it's one of them. with like a multimedia element to it. So, yeah, I think that's...
Well, I know we have to wrap up. As I'm a founding member of SEJ, and I'm so happy to see all of you. You should keep the faith. I think it's got potential to be freelancers. So thanks for being here.